You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 6 November, we've got the Bank of England rate decision this afternoon. Expected no change. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Kia Nanyana Prime XBT. Blue Label announces they're going to be listing Cell C. And then Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley CEOs both warning about a market correction. Not a crash, a correction. We'll get Kia's view on that. Viv Govender, Rand Swiss, the recent hyperscaler results, $300 billion spend, $450 billion next year. I want to get his views on that. And then Trishnir Chunker, sales manager at 91. They've got two actively managed ETFs in the income space coming to market. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, Vodacom, and Please Call Me matter out of court settlement. Amount not disclosed, but details likely to be in next week's interim results. Business day, JC HEPS disclosure rule under review amid cost concerns. The JC is reviewing its HEPS disclosure rule due to the concerns of reporting costs. I think this is a terrible idea. Morning markets. The US is green. S&P was up 0.4%. NASDAQ up 0.7%. The East is mostly green. We've got Sydney off 0.5%. Then Tokyo up just over 1%. Hong Kong just over 1.5% higher. And Tencent 2.2% in the green. Commodities mostly green. Gold futures 3,996. Brent is the red 63.64. Platinum's 1,565. And palladium 1,443. Rand 17.38, Bitcoin 103,600, and top 40 opening call 575 points to the green. That is almost 0.6% higher.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Tony now with Kia Nanyana, Prime XBT. Kia, appreciate the early morning time. Blue Label, and I think this is, I think we've all known it was coming. And they've now finally announced a sense yesterday that they will be listing Cell C. A fairly dense sense announcement, but missing the important point, which is, I suppose, the value, price it'll list at. And of course, and no dates yet. Your thoughts on it? I mean, it's always nice to have a new listing. No one disputes that. But is Cell C a potentially attractive investment?
Hi, Si, and hi to your listeners. I think it's quite wondrous to have two listings so close to each other. I mean, when last did we have that in the past 10 years? But I mean, the concerning part is where are they going to really value Cell C? Because when you look at Cell C's financials and Blue Label's financials, it's technically insolvent.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at currently the liabilities they sit on at the 31st of May 2025 is about $16 billion and the assets about $15 billion. So they technically have negative equity of about $1 billion in terms of book value. So now where are you going to really attach value to this? I think it's good for the Levy brothers to have an exit because of this proposed raising of capital, none is going to go to Cell C. It's all going to go to the subsidiaries that essentially are going to cash out the Levy brothers and make them happy.
Yeah, so, I mean, this really is an exit, and I take your point, the Levy brothers, who are regretting the day they ever bought Cell C. Yeah, absolutely. We'll see. We'll get some details when it lists, but technically insolvent. Not my idea of a great investment. Let's switch to broader markets. We've had, early in the week, both the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanley CEOs both warning around market corrections, 10%, maybe 20% corrections. No one can predict the market, but your thoughts. It's been a stellar year on markets when everything else isn't. I was just having a look at US, the ISM PMI numbers. It's been below 50 for 3 years now. Your thoughts. Is this market looking a little frothy, due for some correction?
I think in every bull market, there is some drawdown and some correction. But I think it's just the mixed signals which are coming out. So, mm-hmm. So I was reading a report yesterday that since 1928, the S&P 500 going into the close of the year has only had 6 times where there's been 6 months of monthly gains going into the end of the year. Mm-hmm. This is the 6th time. But when looking at another stat, I was looking at the AAI survey of institutional asset management managers in the US, and it's sitting in bearish territory, which it increased in the past 2 weeks to about 46.1, which tells me only one thing, that institutional investors currently are searching for performance. Because when I look at the performance of most institutional investors, pension funds, asset managers in the US, they've been lagging the S&P 500. And this might be a bit of benchmark chasing at the moment to get us to these record highs.
I get your point on that. Also, I mean, to your, the bigger picture is, which, I mean, I think our local market up to end of September, we were nine green months, end of October. We were, you know, every month this year had been green. Nothing goes up forever. Even in a bull market, we need some corrections. That's just how markets work.
I think we need to welcome the possibility that they are going to be drawdowns, because I think it presents opportunities for people who are on the sidelines. Yeah. I always say when you're trying to chase benchmarks and you're trying to achieve alpha by being behind the curve and only buying at the top, you essentially just really the statistics don't really even out. But now when there is a 15% to 10% drawdown, it allows market participants who are sitting on cash or sitting on the sidelines to come back into the market and essentially take some of the momentum, like in our case, the platinum and the gold stocks.
Yeah, but that's actually a good point. It gives us an opportunity, a second chance to get into that rally. We'll leave it there. Kenyon Yone, he is from Prime XBT. And our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Sosi, attractive investment? Have your vote, have your say on LinkedIn and Twitter. Give you money, smoother returns for Stanlib Asset Management? The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Viv Govender, Rand Swiss. Viv, appreciate the time. Last week, we saw a bunch of the big tech stocks with numbers out. We've also had some others this week, the likes of AMD. Last week, of course, was Alphabet, Microsoft, Meta. So the list goes on. I've got some thoughts, but before we delve into some of the details, what perhaps was sort of standout for you in the numbers? Because broadly, across the board, I mean, there is money being made and profits are real and giant.
Yeah, they are, but so are the valuations. I mean, we saw Nvidia pass $5 trillion. I mean, understand that we had even like a decade into the first company that hit $1 trillion.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was like 2019 when we had Apple go through $1 trillion. And the valuations we've seen from Nvidia of $5 trillion in like no time, it's incredible. And Palantir as well has done, I think, at 12 times returns in the last 5 years, 120% basically. We've seen, like, you know, the rise of all these AI tech companies, and the valuations here are shocking. And I think the problem is that, you know, the results are not bad, but any excuse, the market's going to turn against you. Look at what they did to Meta. Even though the results weren't that bad, they just got, you know, there was that once-off tax charge that obviously brought things down a bit. But the market punished them, because I think the valuations are so high that any kind of like fear just makes you kind of turn against things at the moment.
I want to touch on Meta, but I also want to, a lot of this is CapEx spend. I mean, and I was doing some digging. You're looking at about $300 billion from the big guys this year, expected to potentially rise to $450 billion next year. Most of it, however, is coming out of cash flow. Aside from Meta, who might borrow next year for it, this is coming from cash flow. So I appreciate the valuations and I appreciate this big spend, but they can kind of afford it.
Yeah, look, I mean, I have a theory about this, if you have a second. So my theory is this, right? So you look at like $300 billion in spend. Generally, companies like, you know, these software companies don't get more than about 5% of the value they create. So Excel, you've got much value. Excel creates, or Word creates, 5% of that goes towards, you know, Microsoft, you know. So if you're looking at that kind of valuation, 20 times the return on the $300 billion has to be created to justify the $300 billion. 20 times $300 billion, it's about $6 trillion. That's twice the GDP of France. You know what I mean? And the second part is this. Most of the stuff that they do is not net positive for GDP. What do I mean by that? I mean, you make better lawyers, like 100 times better lawyers. The world isn't better because your lawyers cancel off by the other guy's lawyers. You make better accountants, same thing. And also when it comes to like the generative AI stuff, like songs and songs, there's only so many songs people listen to. There's always a number one song. Whether it's written by an AI, whether it's written by, like, you know, an individual, it doesn't really matter, because it's still going to be the same GDP. It's almost pretty much the same GDP, no matter what it is, you know what I mean? Box office is kind of say the same as well over time. So I don't see the valuation being created by those things. And so what we have is effectively, you know, replacement of people. That could be something. And that could be, like, you know, create the value. But then you have high unemployment, you know, no massive increase in GDP to compensate for this thing here. And then obviously issues coming down the line. The only thing that rate does create, by view, you know, long term, GDP growth is either scientific innovation or real world physical GDP, AI, like, you know, robots that buy it, robots that manufacture, that kind of stuff. And as yet, we haven't seen the AI stuff really relate to those things. We haven't had any kind of significant scientific invention from AI at the moment, and we have not seen robotics really take off. I mean, the stuff that we see in robotics, more often than not, when you look into it, is usually some human controlling these things remotely.
Absolutely. And that $6 trillion number is giant, because that's my question is, I get the spend and I get what they're trying to do, but $6 trillion is bigger than the entire software as a service industry right now. And that is the challenge. I can see that they all want to be the leader here, but I don't know whether, you know, my $20 a month to ChatGPT doesn't make a dent in that sort of spend. And that's the risk that they have.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, look, I mean, $6 trillion is basically 6% of global GDP. And that is what they're investing this year. So you have to have 6% of global GDP added on, you know, on a year basis for this year's $300 billion. If next year they go up to $450 billion, then you're going to add, like, basically, you know, 20 times that, that's $9 trillion. That's about almost 10% of global GDP added on for that next year's one. And so you see how much GDP growth you need to have to justify the spend. It becomes like quite a daunting feat when you think of it that way. It's not just $6 trillion like once off, it's $6 trillion for this round of spending. Mm-hmm. And the next one's cost another, you know, like I say, another like $9 trillion and so on going forward. If we do get to AGI, all this becomes, you know, mute.
Sure.
What I want to say is this, it's, you know, it's a bit of psychology. It's not quite market related, but look at the profile of the people creating these things. They are usually men over 40, you know, and as you know, people over 40 suddenly have midlife crisis, buy a Ferrari, they see death coming and that kind of stuff. And the guys making the decisions, like the Larry Ellison's, who's much well over 40, but you know, Elon Musk in his 50s, Zuckerberg in his 40s, you know, Sam Altman's much younger.
Yeah.
But these are all guys that basically are already richer than they could ever spend. You know what I mean? They have no like economic real incentive to like make their life better. If, like, I mean, I hear Larry Page said he's willing to go bankrupt to, like, you know, promote AI. Bankruptcy for Larry Page means he's worth a couple of $1 billion. Is it worth a couple hundred billion dollars? You can live a pretty good life with a couple of $1 billion, you know what I mean? And I think that is the thing we should also understand, is that it's almost a ego / spiritual, whatever you want to call it, race that we're getting into right now. And so it may go on longer than we think, even if the GDP doesn't quite justify it. In that scenario, you probably want to be more focused on the guys that sling the shovels than the guys that actually buy the gold.
I get your point on that, absolutely. And so that was going to be my next point, is that, and I look at Meta, and I don't know what Meta's plan is for all their spend. I mean, Llama is free. They're an advertising business more than anything else. Although, truthfully, so to a fair degree is Alphabet. But is this then caution coming out in terms of some of these hyperscalers and saying, you know, let's not all head for the hills, but let's keep a close watch because, you know, valuations are getting stretched and expectations even more so?
Yeah, look, I mean, we need to see it seeing, you know, the next few years. I mean, I think the estimates is by 2030, probably, that this kind of scaling does not progress beyond that. There's just not enough money in the world to get beyond 2030 at this kind of scaling levels. Meta is actually being really good when it comes to AI, because unlike other places, yes, they may be giving a free LLM out there, but their AI also looks at your data and figures out who exactly you are and is able to advertise more clearly to you. And that's one of the big advantages they had when Apple cut them off from in terms of some of the data. They really fell a lot, and this AI stuff is getting them back on track. I mean, the AI data stuff, I mean, we got a new company listing in South Africa that's also doing something similar around credit scores, right? Mm-hmm. I suspect, however, in the longer term, that's going to be really cut down on by governments, because the amount of information that AI can collect on you is shocking.
I hadn't thought of that, absolutely. At some point, we're going to start seeing some regulation. Usually that horse is bolted, but I take your point. It is the insights that they have, of course, is actually just data on individuals. We leave it there. Verf Govender, Rand Swiss, always appreciate the time.
The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Chatting with Trinisha Chunker, Sales Manager and Actively Managed ETF Strategy Lead at 91. Trinisha, appreciate the time. Before we delve into the two ETFs, actively managed ones you've got coming to market next Wednesday, this is a first for 91 in terms of the ETF space. Obviously, a lot of unit trusts, but the first in terms of actively managed ETFs.
Absolutely, Simon. And this is definitely a milestone for our South African business. As you know, 91 is a global investment manager. We were founded right here in South Africa almost 30 years ago. In fact, next year we celebrate 35 years of active investment experience. And our purpose has always been to help our clients achieve long-term results through active management. So we're delighted to be able to bring that expertise and that experience to the JSE in a listed format for investors to access in a new way.
And it's that new way, because these two ETFs, as I understand, they mirror established unit trusts. This really is, I suppose, around a new platform and accessibility for investors.
Absolutely. So these strategies are not new, as you say. Mm-hmm. They're well established. They're trusted funds in our unit trust range. They've been relied upon for years by individual investors, advisors, institutional clients. And it's exactly that. They're just now more accessible than ever. Mm-hmm. On the JSE. So we want to meet our investors where they are. Mm-hmm. And if they prefer to access investments on the JSE, then they can now do that in our trusted strategies.
Let's talk about the two. There is a local and an offshore. The local will be 91DINC, Diversified Income Fund. Talk to me around the methodology around it and what it's trying to achieve.
Perfect. So a diversified income strategy is ideally suited for investors that are sitting or holding excess or idle cash, whether that be in their BDA accounts or in retail bank deposits. The fund targets 1.5 to 2% above SA cash. So if you think you're earning about 6.5 to 7%, you can now earn close to 9% after fees in our diversified income strategy. So we're giving investors the opportunity to really make their cash work harder. But really what sets this fund apart is just our intentional and deliberate focus on preserving capital. So we've always got a capital preservation mindset. So you can sweat your cash, you can earn, you know, a higher return, but you have the peace of mind that, you know, we are very focused on making sure that we don't have any negative returns. And I think that was, you know, the real life test was when we went through COVID.
Yeah.
And during that 3-month period, we didn't have a negative return over that quarter on the fund. Oh. So I think that gives you real comfort around the return and risk signature on the fund. So that diversified income strategy is fully diversified across a range of fixed income asset classes. It invests in cash, in government bonds, corporate bonds, and high quality credit, as well as is a little bit of property and some offshore bonds. So you're really getting access to a portfolio of more than 100 instruments across asset class in a single trade in that fund, and you're earning enhanced returns.
Yeah, I was going to say that 9% is, it's almost equity-like return, but obviously at a fundamentally different risk profile, which is the important point. The offshore one, 91GNC is the code for that one. It's similar-ish, but some nuances. And of course, the key point is this is going to be taking my rands, putting them into dollars, and in essence, getting me a dollar yield, which I will then receive back in rands.
Absolutely. So very similar in structure. It invests across developed and emerging market bonds and all high quality offshore credit. It's targeting an enhanced return above US dollar cash. So it does feed into our global US dollar fund. That fund's also been running. So it's well established. It's got scalable assets in there. But the beauty of the actively managed ETF is that you can trade in rands on the JSE. So you don't have to worry about XCON and, you know, I mean, I know we've just come off the grey list, so things are slightly better in that respect. But, you know, all of that admin and the XCON approvals, et cetera, you don't have to worry about because you just invest in rands. And essentially, you're getting that almost 5% dollar yield, but converted back into rands.
And has that one also got a key sort of eye on the capital preservation?
Absolutely. So both these funds, the mindset or philosophy underlying both of these is there's a very strong participate and protect. That's return signature linked to both of them, where we want you to be able to participate in bond and credit markets when they are doing well, but never at the expense of, you know, not preserving capital. So on the local side, just because we've got, you know, that 9% yield to play with, you know, before you actually start eating into capital, our focus there is we avoid 3-month drawdowns over any quarter. Yeah. On the global side, because you've got a lot less income to work through, that capital preservation mindset is still very much there. But, you know, the fund will avoid drawdowns over a longer 12-month period. But that said, even the offshore fund has never had a negative month since it was launched. So that gives you a sense of just how important the capital preservation mindset is to us.
Yeah, because income's great, but it's important that that capital is still there. And that's a key tenant here. We'll leave it there. Srini Shachankar, sales manager and actively managed ETF strategy lead, 90 One. Appreciate the time.
That's it for today. I was chatting with Simthembile Bopele yesterday at FNB Wealth and Investment. We're talking about the Optasia listing from Tuesday. It was up 2%, but it wasn't the big pop many expected. We asked if that then gave you some opportunity. It was equally split, a third saying, yes, great-looking stock, another third saying, no, all hype, and the last third saying, maybe we will see in time. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. Podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. SAPI results.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.